Welcome to Dialogue Out Loud, where we explore the intersections of Mormonism, current events, and scholarly thought. I'm your host, Margaret Olson Hemming, the co-editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. With me as co-host today is our podcast producer, Daniel Foster Smith. Daniel has an MA in film and literature from the University of York and is an artist and filmmaker himself. So while he's not usually in front of the camera, he is particularly well-suited as a host for this interview. Together, we're delighted to speak with Ryan M. Springer about his article, Heretic and the Inversion of the Mormon Endowment. In the winter 2025 issue of Dialogue, Springer reads Heretic as more than a horror film, arguing that it symbolically mirrors the structure of the Latter-day Saint Temple Endowment. He suggests the movie functions as an inverted initiation narrative, transforming a ritual journey toward divine knowledge into one of deception and captivity. Through this lens, the film becomes a meditation on authority, hidden knowledge, and the struggle between institutional control and spiritual agency. Ryan Springer holds a BS from the University of Utah and a JD from Brigham Young University. An attorney and independent scholar, his work focuses on the intersections of religion and esoterica, combining historical research and analysis with experiential methodologies to explore ceremonial magic and other occult dimensions of the Latter-day Saint movement. Ryan, thank you for joining us with your very specific line of research.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you. Yeah, it's a pretty niche of one.
Yeah, we're totally excited to have you here. This was an article that was different from anything else I've ever read in Dialogue. And, you know, that goes a long way of just saying something new. So give us a summary of the article and your thesis for those who haven't read it, maybe haven't seen the film, but are interested in these ideas. Some of our listeners may be too squeamish to watch a horror film or haven't yet read the article, but are curious to hear about the film and your thoughts about it.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I couldn't be more grateful for the opportunity to talk about this and for the article to get the publication, because it was really fun. This was such an interesting movie. The basic context of the movie, I think, no spoilers here.
We can spoilers.
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll go plenty of spoilers because we're going to go deep. So the basic idea of the movie is that two sister missionaries from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are out doing their standard missionary work, and they encounter this investigator named Mr. Reed, played by Hugh Grant. And it's a missionary meeting gone terribly awry. Mr. Grant's this psychopath who traps the sister missionaries and puts them through these series of trials. And, you know, it's scary and it's a horror movie and it's a thriller and it works on that level. I'm squeamish too. I don't like horror movies in general, but this one hit so many pressure points with me. I mean, it's, it's not every day you get to see a horror movie involving missionaries from your church. So my little brother, who is big into horror movies, he assured me that this would be okay. So I went and saw it with him. And we saw it in the theater. And I remember sitting there watching this narrative unfold. And behind the scenes of the narrative, there were so many distinctive symbols. The hexagon window, that was the one I thought something is at play here, that there's more than a horror movie going on. And then as the sister missionaries descend deeper into Mr. Reed's house, you see that the rooms and the doors take on different dimensions. There are different trials at each stage. And I sat there in the theater, and it had been years since I had gone through the temple, the LDS temple, but the resonance of going through this progression of rooms, it suddenly recalled to me, the ascension journey that goes through in the LDS temple. And that was a ritual, a performance that suddenly resonated with me, although this was this dark inversion of it. And there were a couple of other cues that came out to me. I think the one that really stands out is the intersection at the crossroads where the three sorority sisters come up and confront our sister missionaries. And that's the moment of revelation when this Hecate intersection interval happens, and the protagonist has this moment of revelation. And the Hecate character of these three sisters, that made me think of Pistis Sophia, which is a Gnostic text that I actually first read about in Hugh Nibley Temple and Cosmos 25 years ago when I was a temple prep teacher. Similarly in that it talks about the books of you or Zhu. I'm going to massacre pronunciations on these, but these books of you had maps and they talk about progression. And, you know, over the course of my life, I guess because the World War II books were checked out at the library, I just got interested in esotericism and the occult or whatever you want to call it.
You have to do something.
Got to do something. I mean, there's more to that story, but the more I studied the field of esotericism and began to kind of understand, you know, where these Gnostic texts, these books of you sort of filtered in, you know, came from Egyptian sources and then filtered into the practical magic of the Greco-Roman period. And then how that transmitted through, you know, through the early Christian era and up through the Renaissance and the grimoire phases until it comes to rest in Palmyra, New York. And then we have Joseph Smith, who, I mean, it has influenced my entire life. I'm 50 years old and I, you know, I love the man and have been, you know, ups and downs and things like that. But it has given me a much deeper appreciation, I think, for some of the things that get dismissed, you know, the South Park stone in the hat. That's, you know, pretty easy to make fun of. But when you look at it in a deeper context of these traditions and these rituals, it's almost more, you know, impressive to me. So that digression, I have this collision of interests and pressure points in the movie Heretic. And so that was kind of my thesis that I argue in the article, is that it does depict a descent journey. And there are multiple sources for ascent journeys in Western esotericism within, you know, Gnostic apocryphal scriptures, whatever you want to call them. And that's something that Joseph Smith tapped into in Heretic by using these sister missionaries and the inversion of the faith and some pretty pointed critiques of, you know, Latter-day Saint history, theology, whatever. It was just a once in a lifetime movie for me to geek out.
Okay. Okay, so I want to follow up on this question of the inversion of the LDS temple endowment, which you talk about as an ascent narrative. So what, in your view, would you say is the most radically inverted? There's like between the spatial movement, the symbolic language, or the ultimate purpose of the ritual?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the binary that Mr. Reed sets up in his chapel of belief or disbelief is a false binary. And I think that what happens in the LDS temple through the covenant-making process is that can feel like a surrender of agency. You know, in the LDS temple, we go through and make a series of covenants, and some of those covenants can seem restrictive. And so then it's, you know, it kind of sets up this, am I really choosing to do this? Am I really choosing to live the law of chastity like I have made a covenant to do? Or am I, you're just kind of going through the motions. This binary choice of belief and disbelief, I think, is the critical inversion for the individual who is going through this process. There are also symbolic cues that I think are incredibly significant. Again, the veil is a part of the LDS temple ritual. And we have such a stark contrast of the, you know, the white veil presented in one context and then this very dark black veil, which is still a moment of transition for the protagonist. If it's an initiate going through the LDS temple ceremony, then it is a passing through the veil into a celestial sphere.
for our protagonists and Heretic, they pass through a veil, and it's still a moment of enlightenment. There's still ultimately redemption, but it is a very transformative, difficult experience. And I think that that's something that a lot of, you know, I mean, I don't know, it resonated deeply with me. Everything's hunky-dory when I'm living my covenants and I've got my temple recommended and I can go through and live in the palace. But when life hits the, you know, when life is challenging, there's a darkness, there's a dark counterpart to all of that. And so the inversion that you see as the protagonists, as the initiates progress, ultimately attaining light knowledge, ultimately attaining wisdom, which is what the character in Pistis Sophia, one of the characters, partially does, is makes this journey, having to fall from the heavens, having to descend and then find her way back again. And that can only be done through the intervention of Jesus Christ. That is a component that, however you're characterizing the ritual, that's something that I think resonates deeply with Latter-day Saints who, you know, experience the modern temple endowment.
So the gaining of knowledge and the transformation of the person into a new kind of being is what is the common thread between them both?
I would say that's one common being, you know, that I think that the idea of progression and growth, there is a transformation that can occur. And if you have to go through the abyss to get there, and that's where some of the occult stuff gets fascinating, is you embark on this shadow journey. In the Osirian death cycle, he's mutilated, cut into 13 pieces, and he has to go through 12 hours of nighttime progression. Then he reunifies with Ra. Mr. Reed makes this comparison that, hey, all religions are kind of variants of these old myths and these old stories. And that's an easy place to get locked into that binary of belief and disbelief. And you sometimes miss the bigger picture, like, okay, so what? So that there are these mythologies that constantly reinforce the idea of a family, of a divine father, of a divine mother, and of a son who comes and makes a sacrifice. There's something that resonates deeply with those mythologies across systems. And to see Mr. Reed use the mechanics and the operation of this architecture to manipulate and distort spatial dimensions, which have a ritual component, to use it as control, when the inverse can be true, which like it is the aspiration, I think, of the LDS endowment and modern temple ceremonies, is this aspirational reunification with God. So that inversion kind of works too.
So you talk about him, Mr. Reed, which, by the way, today when I rewatched the film, I actually had this moment of like realizing that perhaps his name was intentionally meant to evoke the word mystery, Mr. Reed. I don't know, that it was, once I was steeped in all of your symbolic readings of this text, I was like, oh, there we go. There's another little nugget.
That's so funny you say that. I rewatched it today, and there's a part where Sister Paxton says it that way. She says, Mr. Reed. I mean, I don't know, but that definitely keyed into that.
So you talk about him as yours being, you know, seeing him as this counterfeit initiator, or and then you bring in this term demiurge. Are we saying that? How do we
say that? That's another character from these. And let me preface this by, when I use the term Gnostic, that comes with a huge caveat. And I try to point this out, it's a bit of a heuristic device, because it is a term that is applied to a very broad there's a lot of different Christianities and different belief systems that get lumped under this umbrella of Gnostic. So I want to be sensitive about that, because the books of you, the idea is that you, J-E-U, is the name of the deity. This is a version of Jehovah, and there is a school of Gnostic thought, and some believe that, I mean, it gets very convoluted, and so I wanted to kind of keep it simple. But the idea is that there is this demiurge creator, that there are many gods, there are Elohim, there is a council of gods, and they all kinds of do different things. There's obviously, you know, there's one source or a monad. The Gnostic cosmology that can be reconstructed is pretty complicated. But in general, there's this idea of a demiurge in the Gospel of John, Yaldabaoth, that there's this entity that gets created and thinks it's and it is in some ways the true God of this world. There's, you know, there's some parallels there, that he is the God of this world. But in order to reach the higher states of Gnosis, in order to reach the higher treasuries of light or these celestial palaces, one has to be able to transcend through the demiurge's false material realm, and then they can escape into the cosmos and ascend through these, they're called treasuries of light, celestial palaces, celestial kingdoms. That's what the Gnostic metaphor, or not metaphor, the motif is, that there is this demiurge who is a false creator. And that's in Heretic, again, I don't know if this is deliberate or if it is just one of these iterations of things that come over and over, but Mr. Reed has very clearly created this leaden cased house where he's got it in miniature. He certainly functions as a demiurge role in Sister Paxton and Sister Barnes' Sophia ascent journey.
So I wanted to explore a little bit as well. You know, I'm new to all of these ideas that almost everything that you present in that article was kind of new territory for me, but it certainly resonated with a lot of other the ideas that Joseph Campbell, you know, introduces about this idea of the hero's journey. And I wonder if you considered that, or where you would see parallels between you know, this type of descent, and do you see it differently in some way than the hero's journey, which typically takes our hero through the underworld before they can emerge back up?
I think it's a very similar thing for, you know, me personally betraying it, that like this is the collective unconscious. The, you know, Carl Jung talks about this in alchemy and in psychoanalysis, that there are archetypes that resonate with the human being that we don't even know why. We don't know why we're taught these principles. But the hero's journey, as Joseph Campbell talks about, there are these mythological narratives and there are these archetypes that for some reason hit triggers within our subconscious or within our conscious. They're things that we resonate with. And so I think that's whether it's a universal principle that's attributed to a religious belief or a set of religious beliefs, or it's something that's going on in the subconscious, there's a writer named Lon Milo Duquette who, you know, if you want to start in on any of this stuff, he's a great on-ramp, but he says it's all in your head. You just don't know how big your head is. And I think there is some of that that's true, that as you feel these things or as you see these symbols, they will trigger something and you don't really know why. And I think that's part of the experience that Sister Paxton and Sister Barnes experience, is they're going through these distorted spaces. They're going through these distorted doors and everything is just off kilter enough that they are vulnerable. And I think that's something that, you know, Latter-day Saint or not, that's something that the human experience can relate to.
So you point out a lot of these symbols that are so overtly chosen by the filmmakers, but as I recall, you're not necessarily arguing that the filmmakers themselves, the writers and directors, were intentionally crafting an anti-endowment structure, or did I miss something in your research that
no,
was part of their approach?
No, I couldn't find anything. I was so curious when I came home and kind of as I started drafting the article, I thought, how overt was this? Where did this come from? And, you know, I didn't know if it was the writers, the directors, and I looked up the cinematographer and like the scene director. You'll probably know a little bit more about this with your background, but it was the guy who did the sets for the Hunger Games.
Mm.
And so he talked about, I guess, in his Hunger Games set design articles that he was able to do a set design that was able to reinforce the idea of control with this dystopian Katniss Everdeen story. But I couldn't find anything to suggest that it was overt. I couldn't find anything that was, you know, they said that, you know, they had keyed in on this, you know, the President Gordon B. Hinckley talk where if it's all true or it's all false. And they said, let's key that to the binary. And so, you know, there was something about that, but in terms of like the hexagons, the intersection with the three headed sisters, the descent, the mirror of, you know, the final rune, you know, we in the temple, we go through the very first step is washings and anointings. What we have in the final room is we've got the caged women who are being sprayed. It's so rich. And I thought, is this deliberate? Or if you're into this woo-woo stuff, there are iterations. We see these patterns come over and over, and it is because there is an underlying operating system. And that's kind of what I, you know, my work, I'm fascinated by this idea of magic as a technology, as an operating system, but religion and belief is something that is related to these operating systems that if you break them down are pretty fundamental. And it you know, it kind of depends on which symbol you plug in here, or which symbol you plug in there, what the operator's intentions are. There's all kinds of crazy stuff. But the idea that there is an underlying technology that is operating on our subconscious that can be either manipulated or controlled, or, you know, that's what magic is. We see this with Mr. Reed using it for nefarious, malevolent purposes. The technology itself is benign. The notion of sacred geometry and transformative spaces, that's a benign technology. But when it is, you know, around something that is aspirational and trying to bring, you know, LDS kids going on their mission closer to God by going on this ascent pilgrimage within a sacred room, or it's, you know, the psycho in a horror movie torturing two missionaries.
I have a bit of a follow-up question on that, because I think this idea of embodiment and control over bodies is pretty significant. So it hits on one of the really big differences between Gnosticism and Mormonism, right? Because with Gnosticism, embodiment is a lesser state. The material world is sort of a kind of prison created by the lesser deity of the demiurge. But Mormonism sees matter as eternal and fundamentally good, and that God organized eternal matter. So for the women in this movie, embodiment is really important, right? I mean, with horror movies in general, embodiment is often crucial, right? Because the body is under threat in some way often.
Almost universally, the female body is the focus of most horror films.
Yes.
With the idea of the final girl, the, you know, having to be the one who can survive, who doesn't get destroyed.
Right. And then there's the one who's sacrificed, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, like who is, and then there's this final scene with Mr. Reed in control of these women's bodies by putting them under lock and key. So can you say more about embodiment in this film?
That is such a great question. And I know, again, I watched it earlier today, and that was something that resonated so much more this time, is putting this in the, you know, you can conceive of the Pistis Sophia, and there is this behind the scenes concept of a divine feminine. And to see the way that this ritual deliberately distorts femininity, and the bookends of, you know, when they start off the movie and they're talking on the bench and they're talking about pornography, and Sister Paxton is speaking innocently about a fairly graphic sex scene, there is a tender femininity there that is so vulnerable. And I think that for her to go through this transformation and to receive the embodiment of physical resurrection or eternal life, but to survive this, I thought that was incredibly empowering. And I thought that was kind of what hit me. She's the cool heretic. She is the one who faces this false binary choice of belief and disbelief. And while she relies on the sacrifice of another, she is the one who fights her way out. She's the one who's clever enough to see through the deception, to see it for what it is, and to see that, hey, if I'm trapped in this map, I can find my way out. I can use this depiction. And, you know, she comes out into the world, and she's there, she's alive, and it's snowy, and maybe that's, you know, eternal progression, who knows what's beyond. But that reclamation of her divine feminine and her survival, the emanations of matter and the difference between, you know, Gnosticism and I certainly don't want to be arguing that Mormonism and Gnosticism are the same thing, and that's not what I want to try to do. But this notion that there are dimensions and that matter can be adjusted in many, I think that's one of the really cool things that Joseph Smith brought about through the Restoration, is, you know, the DNC 88 stuff and the DNC 93 stuff about matter being eternal and about light operating on matter. And you see that in Heretic a little bit, this operation of light, the divine spark, when Elder Kennedy is out there, you know, distracting Mr. Reed, they're able to get the matches, that divine spark. I think that, you know, those are the kinds of symbols that resonate deeply, but Heretic does a wonderful job of taking, traditionally, you know, the women are always the victims, and in this case they certainly are victimized, but Sister Paxton, she hits moksha, she breaks out, and she does it intact.
You know, we actually did another episode when this film came out. We had a panel get together and do a conversation about this. And when you were describing that opening scene, I was remembering some of the comments that were made. And I can't remember who we had on the panel then, but there was a woman who had served a Mormon mission, and she had a really different read on that opening scene. And drawing from her own experience of being a sister missionary, she said that what she saw, especially in the context of how Sister Paxton evolves, or what we see of Sister Paxton and how what she's capable of throughout the film, she looks back on that opening scene through a different lens and sees the conversation about pornography with the companion not as one of innocence, but one of probing, one of knowledge, which she already has, which she is carefully, subtly checking to see how will my companion respond to what I'm putting out in this information, with this information about my experiences and my knowledge of carnal acts, etc. And so I just in that context of, you know, this evolution, she certainly does go through that journey of seeming innocent, certainly to those around her, and then coming out enlightened or something, you know. And I'd like to hear if you have any thoughts there.
I do, and I realize I'm on censor. I mean, I'm a there are certain things about the sacred divine feminine that I just don't, I'm not equipped to talk about, but I believe in it a lot. And one of the things I think about is, yes, that there is, and that's what I would love to hear more of. I mean, I have my perspective on this about, you know, the demiurge and all the stuff I'm interested in. But the feminine idea and how that resonates with women in the church, and I'm going to have to go back and listen to that, because I think there is an element to that. I mean, this goes to the garden and Eve partaking of the fruit, and you know, let's not delude ourselves that the sacred feminine is some sort of purely virginal role. There is exploration, there is partaking of that fruit, there is that you know, that sacred and the profane. It's dirty until you get married, and then suddenly it's a celestial sacrament. That's a complexity that's one of the things that we go through in life. Those are the challenges that we hit, and whether it's a room in Mr. Reed's dungeon or it's our family relationships, you know, going through this mortal estate, those are the kinds of complexities that it grapples and confronts. And I would love to hear more about that, you know, talking about starting dialogue.
I would love to maybe come back to this idea, though, of comparing the inverted initiation or the idea of if the temple endowment is this model of spiritual ascent, and you argue that this film depicts a sort of anti-endowment, a spiritual descent, are we to conclude, or how would we look at the final emergence of Sister Paxton? Is she enlightened at the end, does a dark endowment, an anti endowment, not yield the light and knowledge?
My very ambiguous ending, right? And I think deliberately so. My heart has always been full. I've seen it probably 20 times now, and that redemptive moment of, you know, the butterfly manifesting on her finger, just the way she had told Sister Barnes. You know, you go through some dark stuff in life, and this is an exaggerated example of it. That's exactly why ritual works, is you go and you make method teachings, you make method where you incorporate covenants or whatever it is. Once you rehearse and perform these rituals over and over, that's kind of how we program our brains, I think. And we have Sister Paxton experience this. And, you know, the myths or the stories, whether it's Pistis Sophia or the Books of You or the Book of Mormon, these stories, these narratives, they're there for a reason. And they are morality tales. And whether it's a, you know, this horrible labyrinthine demiurge Saturnian dungeon of Mr. Reed, or it's the temple and the Latter-day Saint experience, something is supposed to be happening by experiencing and living a symbol and being in a part of it. I think Sister Paxton grows. I think it's a Pistis Sophia narrative where she has this, you know, this at-one-ment. There's the sacrifice. You know, Sister Barnes had died, come back. She knew some secrets of the afterlife, and she was able to bestow that, you know, that grace and that wisdom. Sister, I think that is critical, that Sister Paxton couldn't do this alone. There was an at-one-ment with a savior salvific figure who happens to whack Mr. Reed in the temple with a nail. There's, you know, some certain rhythms there anyway.
So God's plan wins out, even with the dark demiurge leading.
All right, I'm a white lodger. I always, yeah, I'm always looking for the good on it. That's how I read it. I, you know, you can take it with ambiguity, but I like to think it's a happy ending for a horror movie.
Well, maybe as we bring it to a close here, a final question might be, if someone was to watch the film after reading your article, what single pattern or image would you like them to see that might you know, bring a little bit of spark or enlightenment to their watching.
I'm big on the Saturn stuff. The veil. I think the veil is such a transformative experience in that there are trials that Sister Paxton and Sister Barnes encounter as he's testing their faith. Just as in Pista Sophia, she has to go through these seven repentances and kind of realize flaws in how she can gain wisdom. But there is that transformative experience at the veil. And that's what the notion that the veil is something that is tangible, that can be seen, that can be walked through in a ritualistic space, or the veil is something that can be experienced on this subconscious level, on a spiritual level, that the veil can be very thin, and that where we are and the rituals that we perform can have an effect on both sides of that veil. That's not too woo-woo.
No, I love it. Wow. Well, thank you for joining us on Dialogue Out Loud today for this conversation about the movie Heretic, not just as a psychological thriller, but as a layered meditation on ritual, authority, dissent, and the fragile line between revelation and control. And I hope, if nothing else, this conversation reminds us that stories about faith are rarely just about belief. Ryan, thank you for helping us see Heretic with new eyes.
Thank you very much. This was fun. I appreciate it.
And to our listeners, if this episode sparked something for you, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, keep asking better questions and keep paying attention to the symbols hiding in plain sight. Don't forget to subscribe to Dialogue Out Loud, leave a review, and share this episode with someone you care about. You can read Ryan Springer's entire article for free at dialoguejournal.com. I'm Margaret Olson Hemming with our podcast producer, Daniel Foster Smith. Thank you for listening.
Greetings, my name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.